Coming up, got my thoughts on the Lu Dort trade, what's next for LeBron James, and then Isaac Trotter joins me to talk about NBA Summer League and Caden Daughtry, who had a massive week at Peach Jam, potential number one pick in the 2028 NBA draft. And then later, Esper Rahini, friend of the show, joins to talk about Allen Graves from the Raptors. And then we talk about our experiences seeing the Odyssey in 7mm IMAX over the weekend. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We're talking Summer League takeaways today, but first we got a trade to talk about and a little bit of a LeBron stuff. Lu Dort has been traded to the Atlanta Hawks in a three-way deal. The Thunder are receiving 3 second-round draft picks, and the Mavericks are getting Zachary Richardson, former number one pick from Atlanta. The Hawks are getting Lu Dort and Ryan Nemhard, point guard from the Dallas Mavericks. From the Thunder side of things, this is obviously disappointing to lose one of your longtime two-way guys and Lu Dort, but I think this is a smart move overall for OKC, both to reset the second apron and the luxury tax. This is a team that is trying to compete for a decade, so it makes sense not to go into the tax for Lu Dort, who, let's be honest, really good player. I don't want to dismiss that, but he was borderline unplayable against the Spurs. Okay, like that's just the reality of it. He was borderline unplayable. He is a liability as a three-point shooter, career 32% from three in the playoffs. He is a guy the defenses sag off. It clogs driving lanes for SGA and J-Dub. And I think Sam Presti, it is so fascinating that he went public with a quote to the Oklahoman. He said, "This was a financial decision. The impression I have been given is that the savings generated this summer and from being out of the tax the last several years will be reallocated to future teams. Along with other new well-documented revenue streams, this will allow us to make more basketball-related decisions over the next several years." For Presti to go public to the Oklahoman, my gut feeling is that this is all calculated from the Thunder. Everything they do is so calculated, Presti in particular. I think that this was ownership and Presti collectively deciding, we're going to throw you under the bus, ownership, and make this out to be as a purely financial decision to make our job, the front office's job, easier at managing the personalities on the team, to make them think this is ownership deciding that we need to get under the tax here, not the front office deciding that we need to get under the tax here and that Lu Dort is a player that we want to move away because we have other guys on this team who are deserving of opportunities. That's my gut feeling. I think that the Thunder are making a smart basketball move here because of all the other players on the team that they have. Cason Wallace deserves more opportunities. Kenrich Williams deserves more opportunities. And these are cheaper players who can offer something a little different than Lu Dort. Of course, like they aren't necessarily as nearly as stellar as he is on the defensive end of the floor. But I think this Thunder team has so many young guys. Like, where are you going to get minutes for Nikola Topic? Topic isn't a Lu Dort type of player, but that's kind of the point. With the ball handling and the playmaking that he provides, you just drafted guys this year. You drafted Bennett Sturts. You moved up to go get Bennett Sturts. Sturts is a guard, but maybe you want to have more playmaking in those Dort minutes now. And so my gut feeling is that this was all calculated by the Thunder. Now they're using the second apron, as I said, as a very convenient excuse to move off of a beloved teammate. That's my gut feeling, especially the fact that Presti actually went public with it, with that quote to a local newspaper with Justin Martinez at the Oklahoman. So that may or may not be the case. Maybe it was a pure financial move. I don't think so. I think this was a smart basketball move for the Thunder. And as someone who grew up as a Patriots fan, seeing them trade away guys before it's made sense to do so, fans go crazy. Oh, this is horrible. Oftentimes the Patriots were in the right to get rid of Lawyer Malloy and Richard Seymour and guys like that before it was a popular thing to do. And I think that's the case here for the Thunder. For the Hawks, they get Dort and they get Ryan Nemhard. I love Ryan Nemhard. I've been a fan of him a long time, going back to college at Gonzaga. Lu Dort, I like Lu Dort too. But I don't love this trade for the Atlanta Hawks. I don't love it in part because this is adding another shaky or iffy shooter to the roster. Dyson Daniels offers a lot in terms of his connective playmaking ability. Lu Dort does not. I think with Dort as a guy who doesn't offer a lot off the dribble and is a shaky shooter. And then you also have Dyson Daniels, who is a complete non-factor as a shooter and in the playoffs wasn't nearly as effective offensively. You have a lot of holes offensively that defenses can game plan against when it comes to playoff basketball. Regular season, I'm not worried. I like the Hawks are going to be tough to score on with all their versatility in the front court. Now you have Nickeil Alexander-Walker and Lu Dort and Dyson Daniels. Like, this is going to be a really hard team to score on. But I do worry come playoff time with what this team could actually end up resembling. And for them to also give up Zachary Risacher and 2 second-round draft picks, Hawks fans know I am not a Risacher fan. I had him 11th on my board in that draft class when the Hawks took him number one. I did not like the pick. I said it was a mistake at the time, and it was one of the things I was right about that year, with Risacher being a guy who just has role player upside. All that said, he does have role player upside. He shot 38% on catch and shoot threes last year. He still has a lot of length and potential versatility on the defensive end of the floor. He easily could be a really solid 3-and-D role player for Dallas moving forward. And for the Hawks to give up a guy that they invested the number one pick in just 2 years ago, entering year three of his career when he's only 21 years old with 2 second-round draft picks for Dort, who's due for a big payday a year from now, I don't love it from a value standpoint for Atlanta. Whereas for Dallas, again, I'm not a believer in Risacher in terms of returning top five draft pick returns. I just don't see that from Risacher. He's just so ineffective off the dribble. He's a complete non-factor at generating his own shot and generating shots for others. And offensively, I still have questions about what his peak level is as a shooter. 38% on catch and shoot threes is encouraging last year, but we'll see if he can be a guy come playoff time to maintain that percentage, who can hit a one dribble side dribble three pointer against a closeout. Those are the shots that matter in the playoffs. But for a undrafted point guard and Ryan Nembhard and a single second round draft pick, sign me up. Sign me up for Zachary Risacher at that price. From a value standpoint, this is a gift served on a platter for the Dallas Mavericks. It makes all the sense in the world for them to do. I love it for Dallas. And even though I like Ryan Nembhard a lot, he's still a guy who's playing behind Kyrie Irving, who's back this year, playing behind Sergio De La Rea, who showed great flashes as a creator in summer league as a first round pick for the Dallas Mavericks. So it was an expendable player in Nembhard in a single second for a former number one pick. Give me that deal all day if I'm Dallas. So I liked it for Dallas. Didn't love it for the Hawks, and I really think it's a smart deal for the Thunder, despite the way Presti's spinning it. I don't buy it. I think it is exactly that. I think it's just pure spin to help manage the roster, to manage the guys in the locker room, and help make the fans understand that, hey, I'm just going to throw ownership under the bus because it's a little bit of good cop, bad cop. That's what I think is happening there with the Thunder. LeBron James. It is 12:50 p.m. Eastern as of recording right now, and I haven't seen a notification with Shams making his decision yet. That has not happened with LeBron leaking his decision or making his decision. I haven't seen a Shams post about that quite yet. I think with LeBron, you know, I heard Bill Simmons say on his podcast he still thinks it's going to be Cleveland. The Lebatard guys think it's going to be Miami. Everybody seems to know something about where LeBron's going to do, what LeBron's going to do. I know some of the streamer guys, Logan Paul and Neon, they were teasing that they know where LeBron is going at Fanatics Fest over the weekend. I don't think anybody actually knows what's going to happen here, because the sources I've spoken to about this is that LeBron has golfed with players. He did the podcast with Halliburton. He has Sixers players and players in the Heat and players in the Warriors texting and calling him and recruiting him every day. And that the people I've talked to that know those players, they say they don't know. And that normally this is something that they would know. And that those players have no idea. They're all in the dark. All of them are in the dark. And so if the players that are, you know, 1 degree of separation away from LeBron James don't know what LeBron James is doing, I don't think anybody really knows. I don't. I think this is all just speculation right now, and that nobody actually knows what LeBron James is going to do. I know the Miami Heat are currently listed as the favorites on the prediction markets over at Pauly Market. I don't know how much you're going to put into that. Boston was the favorite on the day Giannis got traded to Miami. What the favorite is just what people are betting on. that's all that is with those numbers you see with the prediction markets. I don't know where LeBron is going to go. I have my opinions on where he should go. I still hope it's Minnesota or Philadelphia. Those are the two teams that have never been the favorites. We have seen Cleveland be the favorite. We have seen Golden State be the favorite. We have seen Miami be the favorite for LeBron James. I'd love for him to choose a new team, Minnesota, Philadelphia, or Golden State. I would love to see a situation like that for this next chapter of LeBron James's career. And the other thing with LeBron, out of Fanatics Fest that happened this weekend, LeBron had an interesting quote. He kind of, maybe he misspoke. Maybe he was just talking off the dome, you know. He said, for the next few years, and then he kind of corrected himself, or the next year, or the next 2 years. But he initially said for the next few years, he said about his career moving forward. Does that mean LeBron wants to play 3 more years in the NBA? The Olympics are in Los Angeles in 2028. Does he want to retire after 2 more years and then win a gold medal? Does he want to have his farewell tour after winning gold in 2028, which would be his 26th NBA season? I think a few years is very possible. And the other thing is LeBron had a quote at Fanatics Fest talking about how, you know, Bruce Springsteen and the Rolling Stones, they tour for 50 years and nobody says that they need to retire. Why can't basketball players be like that too? I think LeBron James plays, you know, 2 or 3 more NBA seasons. And then after that, he goes into his Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen tours with Project B. I think he pivots from the NBA after some amount of years into being like the F1 style league that's launching in 2027, Project B, that's going to have a men's and women's league that tours around the world. I think LeBron is building towards that. And so I don't know if that means he does a Cleveland homecoming. I don't know if it means he does a Miami reunion. I don't know if it means that he's just going to put on a new jersey for the first time to kind of prime the pump for him wearing different jerseys for the next few decades in his career playing basketball. But I don't think anybody knows what LeBron James is going to do. But I do think he's hinting very strongly that we're going to see LeBron for a few more years in the NBA and for a lot more years playing basketball outside the NBA. That's my gut feeling from this weekend at Fanatics Fest with everything I've heard from conversations I've had and from what LeBron James himself said with a microphone in his face. But we don't know what he's going to do. Let's get this over with LeBron. Let's go. Let's go. Come on. Make your choice. Let's go. I saw Stephen A. Smith said this is nearing the indecision. It sure as hell is the indecision. Let's get this over with. Let's make your choice. I can't wait to see that notey pop up on my phone to go live here on Yahoo Sports NBA. Be sure to subscribe if you have not done so already. And also subscribe to my podcast, The Kevin O'Connor Show, wherever you get that, because we're going to do an emergency podcast whenever LeBron decides and wherever he decides to go. Up next, I got S. Barahini talking about Allen Graves in the Odyssey. But first, get Isaac Trotter from CBS Sports. He's a national college basketball writer there. We talked about some of our summer league takeaways and also looked ahead to 2028 and 2027 draft classes because, hey, Caden Daughtry had a week that looked like AI, looked like Stephen Curry, Kyrie level stuff. And he's a prospect that I want you to hear on this show here. Caden Daughtry, remember that name? Up next, talking about him is Isaac Trotter. All right, now joining me from CBS Sports, it's national college basketball writer Isaac Trotter. Isaac, what's up, man?
What's up? Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you coming on today, man. I know you just spent the last few days out in South Carolina at Peach Jam. We're going to start off talking about Las Vegas Summer League, though. The Warriors, they won the championship. They beat the Grizzlies on Sunday night. It was the best championship game of the day. Way more exciting than the World Cup. No offense to the World Cup, but the Summer League title game took the cake for me, Isaac. It was a lot of fun to watch that comeback by Golden State in the fourth quarter. Jaxel Lindenborg, 6 games in July, 15 points per game, 36% from 3, 7 boards, 4 assists. He had 20 and 10 in the final. Yaxel looked like a easy transition for him so far to the NBA.
No question. He just looks like an NBA player, right? I think that's something that we've noticed for a really long time, especially even dating back to early in that Michigan tenure. You're like, oh, that's what an NBA player looks like. I like the little bit of a rivalry that's starting here with Cam Boozer and Yaxel Lindeborg, arguably two of the best three players in college basketball this past season alongside AJ DeBonsa. They had some head-to-head wars when Duke played Michigan, and then we saw them go toe-to-toe again in this one. And I just think that Yaxel's ability just to impact the game in every single facet is really, really impressive. He can pass, he can dribble, he can shoot, he can cut, he defends. And that's the type of opportunity he has to take advantage of if he wants to get on the floor early and often for this Warriors group.
I was just so impressed by the versatility with him, the three-point shooting, the attacking off the dribble, the playmaking, the feel for the game that he has. And I think with his defense, that should be even better in the NBA moving forward. I still think he's working his way back from that injury that he had in the tournament. It is sort of my impression from people I've talked to and from just seeing him play, moving on defense. He was better earlier in the season at Michigan. But ultimately, to me, he looks like a clear-cut, long-time NBA pro. I don't care that he's older for a rookie. It's irrelevant when it comes to the fact he's still super young in terms of the grand scheme of things at 23, nearly 24 years old. He still has a long future ahead of him. I still think it's so funny. Like, he always says something. He always like does something so good on the court, and then after the game, he says about the Grizzlies, man, their butts got tight. They puckered up. You know what I mean? Some of us are built for this moment and some aren't. It's like, oh my God, Yaxel.
This is the Yaxel Lindeborg experience. Like, he is going to say something every single time. I think I was in person when they played the Sweet 16 game against Alabama. And, you know, he torched Amari Allen, who was on NBA draft boards at that point. And the quote after that game was like, I thought it was just so disrespectful that they put a freshman on me. And then he's like calling Michigan State little brother like multiple times after they played him. Like, this is just how he rolls. Like, he has no off switch. Interesting cat, I would say, from talking to people around the Michigan program. He's a bit of an interesting cat, but like, this is kind of who he is. I kind of respect just how genuine he is about the whole ordeal. And when you're really, really good, all of that goes away. Although he may have to tone this down in the regular season, because like, this stuff is not going to fly forever.
Well, I thought it was also funny in his post-game interview, he thanked the jersey sponsor. What a way to start the IRN, the organization and sponsorship. It's like, what? Why are you thanking the jersey sponsor? He's a goofy guy. I respect him for it. It's like Dusty May said on my podcast a few months ago, you know you're getting an authentic person who's true to himself. And so I appreciate that. Draymond Green clearly doesn't. Draymond Green basically told him to shut up when Yaxel was asked for what the case is for LeBron James to choose the Warriors. And Yaxel's like, well, I'm not like other rookies. You can come here and play with one of the greatest shooters ever in with Draymond, and I'm not like other rookies. And Draymond's like, it was pointless. Shut up. It's like, Draymond, don't punch the guy. Relax. Come on.
You know what? Draymond can say whatever he wants right now, but when the season starts and Yax is helping them win basketball games, I think all of these problems will go away, mm-hmm. right? Like, a lot of those issues will go away. Although the press conferences between both those two dudes are going to be really, really interesting, because I'm guessing some side eyes are going to be in play here. Like, we know how that relationship is going to go. What if this is a pivot, though? What if Draymond just turns into Yax's vet and they get along really great? Like, that could be in play.
It's very possible. I could see that happening. I did think it was funny how Yaxel said how some people are built for this, while he got saved by the refs on that Cam Boozer steal. Boozer clearly stole the ball from Yaxel Lindeborg, and while laying it up, the official clearly doesn't know what they're doing, gave the timeout to the Warriors basically after the ball was out of Yaxel Lindenborg's hands. I thought the replay showed this very clearly. From what I could tell, from the angles I saw, seemed like the Grizzlies got completely screwed in this situation. Not as screwed as they did with the draft lottery rules with their pick they got from the Utah Jazz. Not nearly as screwed there, but still screwed nonetheless. Even though it's summer league, if I were a Grizzlies fan this morning, I'd still be feeling a certain way, even though it's just summer league. It was just a horrible call at the end of the game there.
bad call, but I do think it does show a little bit of like how much this stuff matters to Cam Boozer. And I think if you're a Grizzlies fan, you're leaving this really with a lot of positive impressions about this rookie because he cares. I think his body looks great. I think he's slimmed down a little bit. And his game, like, does he ever play poorly? I know there's gonna be nights where shots don't go in, but like the process of like, what am I getting to? What is my reads? What am I doing on the glass? What am I bringing defensively? Like his process and how he approaches the game every single time he plays is always the right approach. And so even on the nights when shots don't go in, like I still think he's positively impacting his team and helping his team. You can't say that about everybody. I know it didn't end as well as they wanted. And the turnover also late with 8 seconds to go was a little bit frustrating. I thought they ran it great. They had the three potentially for Coward to tie the game. Like it was going to be wide open if they had connected on that late pass. But overall, if I'm a Grizzlies fan, I'm ecstatic that Cam Boozer's on my team right now.
Yeah, I'd be ecstatic as well. He averaged 19-8-4 during summer league for the Memphis Grizzlies and just looked like a veteran out there. I mean, he's the youngest player in the first round drafted playing against the oldest in Jaxel Lundenborg, and Boozer just looks like a vet the way he operates on the court. And I thought there was a lot of times in that fourth quarter where the Grizzlies weren't getting him touches. I'm like, get the ball to Boozer. Like, what is going on with this dysfunctional offense? Get the ball in Boozer's hands. And same thing with Cedric Coward too. Like he was very good in summer league for the Memphis Grizzlies after an all rookie season. 19-7-4, he shot 42% from three, and we know with college a very small sample size with the injuries that he had playing six games his final year at Washington State, then goes to the NBA, becomes a lottery pick, didn't shoot well last year for Memphis, found his shot with the Grizzlies in summer league. So I looked at various sports betting over-unders for wins, and they have the Grizzlies at 28.5. And that just feels, at least in my opinion, too low. I'm hammering the over there. I'm not much of a better, but I am betting on the Grizzlies to hit that over with Edie back, Cedric Coward year two, Cam Boozer on the team now, really good depth, a lot of good young pieces. Ty Jerome as a veteran there, as their guard, who was excellent to close the season before the Grizzlies shut him down because they were tanking. I think the Grizzlies are an easy over, and we saw a preview of that with how their performance this summer league, I thought.
You know, I think the thing, too, that I think about with Memphis a lot is, like, on the nights that Cameron Boozer and Zach Edey play together, their floor feels pretty high because they're going to rebound, right? Like it's like the offensive rebounding impact that you have with both those two guys on the floor together is very clear. And I also think that they're set up to be a really good defensive rebounding team when those two guys are there. And I like the offensive flow that they can kind of start to get into a little bit with the, you know, the Cam Boozer, Zach Edey pick and rolls. That's one thing I noticed a lot with the Grizzlies at times is they're very comfortable using Boozer as a pick and roll initiator. And he put a couple defenders into jail, basically on his back hip, trying to decipher the defense, find the open man. Like, I think that gives them some avenues to work through. So we'll see on the 28.5 on that regard. Obviously injuries are going to have a big say on that and just who can stay healthy over the long course of the season. But I think if one of my bigger takeaways with the Grizzlies is like, I kind of feel like Cameron Boozer is going to be the runaway player or rookie of the year. Like that feels like the safest bet for me on the board. I know Caleb Wilson's had an awesome, you know, summer league. AJ DeBonce is a freak. Darren Peterson's a freak. But that combination of like the usage rate and the ability to impact the game in so many ways offensively. And I think he has the best path to being a top number one option on his roster. I think Cam Boozer has not dissuaded any of my thoughts that he's going to be the rookie of the year next year.
Yeah, I think that's I can't bet on awards as a voter, but like I think Cam Boozer would be who I'd rank as the favorite for rookie of the year right now over those other guys, even if those other guys end up better players long term. And I don't know if they will. I had Boozer as my top ranked prospect on the board, but Boozer I think would be the good bet for rookie of the year, in part because he's going to put up numbers and in part because I think it's going to happen in a winning environment. I wouldn't be surprised if the Grizzlies crack 40 wins. I mean, front court with Zach Edey, they had a plus 17 net rating last year with Edey on the floor. Now you add Isaiah Stewart and Quentin Post with Cam Boozer as a rookie. Those are your bigs. You add Jeremy Grant, who had a really good year for the Portland Trailblazers before getting injured late, as your veteran wing with Cedric Coward in year two. Jalen Wells is a really good two-way guy. G.G. Jackson, entering year three now, maybe has a big year. I'm not expecting a lot from Kareem Lopez deeper off the bench, or even Taylor Hendricks, guys like that. But the backcourt, Scottie Pippen Jr., Ty Jerome, Cam Spencer. Like, this is a really good and deep team. And I think for Memphis, this was just a hint of what they could be this coming year as one of the more underrated teams in the league. A team that I don't think is going to be good, but you feel like there's something to feel good about, is the Milwaukee Bucks, because of Brayden Burries, who once again had another big game this weekend, 20-plus points, high efficiency, three-level scoring like we talked about last week on the podcast. He's looking one of the clear-cut steals as the 10th pick in the draft for Milwaukee. After following him all last year at Arizona, Isaac, what have you seen from Burry's development? What's new in his game? How are things translated for him so far in your analysis?
To be honest, Burries is one of the oldest players in this rookie class. So, like, I kind of expected him to walk into summer league and be really, really good. Although I will say he's been even better than I thought. You know, I think the biggest stride that I've seen from him is just a little bit more on ball utility, right? Like at Arizona, like, they were a kind of a good offense that, like, everybody could eat, but their most important offensive, like, action was like, hey, how can we defensive rebound and run and score in transition? And Burries was obviously fantastic at that. But, like, the ability to actually play on the ball and get lead ball reps, he got a decent amount at Arizona, but not and really, like, on that same level of, like, a Darius Acuff, of a Keaton Wagler, of a Mikael Brown Jr. But this year in summer league, I feel like his ability to play on the ball, to pressure the rim, to have outs in the middle of the floor with his pull-up jumper. Obviously, the three is obviously a huge part of his game as well. And then the physicality, like, he just takes a lot of bumps and just doesn't seem to get knocked off his spot at all. That's all really, really good stuff. And for a Bucks backcourt that is very wide open right now, it's hard to watch summer league and not be like, Brayden Burries needs to lead this team in pick and roll reps next year.
You mentioned Keaton Wagler in passing. I know the Clippers did strongly consider Brayden Burries with the fifth pick, and they also considered trade down opportunities where I think Burries would have been one of their primary targets. If we were redrafting today, the Clippers still take Wagler fifth?
I do. I have actually been as encouraged with Keaton Wagler's summer league as anybody. I know that sounds weird because the first three halves were really brutal, but I just think his, like, maturity and, like, his mental toughness to get back off the mat has been really, really impressive, right? Like, guys have 10 fouls. They are heating him up like crazy in this summer league, right? Like, they're being super, super physical. We know the physicality is going to be a part of his game that he has to improve on, but his ability to constantly problem solve and find ways to impact the game is outstanding. I thought he got better and better with time. The jumper is, like, automatic. He looks huge on the floor as well. And there's obviously parts of his game that he's going to have to round out, right? Like, his finishing at the rim over length is a problem. I think he's trying to work on his deceleration and finding ways to create separation off the bounce. That's something that I think he struggled with. Adding more to his game with a floater or that pull-up 15-footer, I think, is going to be a huge part of keeping defenders honest. But, like, guys got knocked down on the mat looking like he was, maybe a bust after the first three halves. Everybody's freaking out. His ability to get back up, continue to impact his team in positive ways is something that I think says a lot about the kid and says a lot about his future in this league.
I agree with every word. I mean, look, I'm not going to overreact to three crappy halves and in summer league. It's just summer league. We've seen, like, Jalen Brunson was terrible in his first summer league too, and he becomes a finals MVP, one of the best point guards in the league. It's like, you're not going to overreact to any of this in one way or the other. I think especially for a guy like Wagler, where there's an athletic translation for him that needs to occur. And I think for him long term, he's still going to be a really good level, really good point guard in the NBA. It's just a matter of what level he ends up reaching. Last thing about summer league before we talk about Peach Jam, Isaac, was there an impressive second or third year player that stuck out to you that you watched?
Interesting. You know, I watched Sean Padula and I'm like, that guy can really play in this league. Like, he can absolutely play in this league. His ability to, he pulls from 30 feet and just looks terrific in that regard. I think his ability to play on or off the ball certainly helps him, right? It's hard not to make, like, the Peyton Pritchard type of comp for him. But I look again at this Clippers team that has so many openings. And as I was watching Keaton Wagler, I'm like, man, every time that Keaton Wagler is at his best, it feels like Sean Badula is on the floor, making him a little bit better and continuing to get him easier shots. I just think he's a guy I've been really high on dating back to his days at Virginia Tech. And he transfers and goes to Ole Miss and plays under Chris Beard. And he just continually problem solves. I think he's going to find a way to be really, really impactful for the Clippers next year.
That it's a good call. I mean, with Padula for underrated guys. I think that's a good one there. What did he have, like 10 out of 15 points in their overtime game? Something like that. I think 10, I forget the exact number, but 10 out of 15 in overtime, if I remember correctly, just took over.
He's just cold. He is just cold, and he just makes guys better too. And obviously the jumper is just auto with him. So he's somebody I definitely want to bet on as well. I was pleasantly surprised with how well he played in summer league.
I think another deeper cut name, Zion Polan from the Minnesota Timberwolves, a two-way guy on their roster out of Florida. Now entering year three, he had the first game was like nearly a triple double. The average big numbers every single game after a really stellar G League season last year. I think Polan is a guy that deserves an opportunity in the NBA. Very impressed by him. But I think for like bigger name guys, come on, Malawach for the Phoenix Suns. Looks like a potential game changer. Just looked stronger. He looked quicker defensively, blocking everything around the rim, showing a bit of versatility as well. And then offensively, just banging threes with his size. There's so, like, we talk so much in the league nowadays about how bigs have evolved to the perimeter, but there's still not a lot of guys that are elite three-point shooters and elite shot blockers. And Malawach looks like a guy who could be on that trajectory. And for the Phoenix Suns, that changes what they could be as a team when you have a guy that can do both of those things, especially pairing him with Koa Pete, Rashir Fleming, guys like that in the front court. Phoenix could suddenly be this really, really, really like a strong, big, long-armed, versatile team surrounding Devin Booker. And I think if you're projecting them forward, that's going to be pretty exciting if you're a Suns fan, and Malawach being a big part of that to accelerate things moving forward.
I mean, he's just enormous too. And I think we all knew that like there was a development curve that needed to happen with him, right? Like a little bit of a late start to play basketball, like his freshman year at Duke, like they had to kind of work him into this, to the rotation a little bit. We didn't get to see a lot of his perimeter game, but like the size, the physicality, the rim protection, the offensive rebounding, and then you toss in the threes as like a little cherry on top. Like I don't want, come on, Malawach to like, you know, beat Kristaps Porzingis where he's taking 6, 7, 8 threes in a game. Like I want the threes to be an additive part of his game, not like the key, like meat and potatoes of his game. But that it's just such a game changer, and it's now or never, right? Like it's time for him to consistently be a huge part of this rotation, and the Suns certainly need it. But you're right. Like that, like physicality is the craze in the NBA right now. And if Malawach is really, really physical, and then Koa Pete, whose calling card is physicality, right? I think I comped him to like a 6'9" fire hydrant. Like if those are the two guys that are a huge part of your a front court, physicality will not be a question for the Suns moving forward.
We'll be right back. So you spent the last four nights at Peach Jam, and the guy who went very viral is Caden Daughtry. Caden was 9th ranked on your board, I believe. Is it specifically your board or is it a group board at 24/7 Sports? Entering,
yeah,
the
it's
week?
A group board. I'm not. Okay. I'm not in charge of that one.
Okay. So, but not, he's not number one. The number one player on most boards for the 2027 high school class, the 2028 NBA draft class, is Beckham Black, who is the brother of Anthony Black. But the big star of the week was Caden Daughtry, who is continuing a really stellar year for him. He led his high school team, Calvary Christian Academy, to a second straight title. He won a gold medal with Team USA, and then he won the Peach Jam Championship and MVP of the EYBL. And some of the highlights on screen for people watching on YouTube, 6 foot tall, roughly, 32 points per game, shot nearly 50% from three steals per game, an elite assist to turnover ratio. He looked like the guy is gonna get Stephen Curry comps. It's gonna happen. Like this is gonna be the first player people compare to Stephen Curry. Fair or not, that's what's gonna be happening here with Caden Daughtry.
he gives me Trae Young vibes, to be honest. That's the guy that I keep looking at with him, because the paint touch on demand that he brings to the floor is just insane. And like, I'm going into Peach Jam, there's games starting left and right, and like day after day, I'm like, when does Caden Daughtry play? Because I just got to watch this guy play. Like, I just have to watch him play. He's so intoxicating with his style of play because of the speed, how uncomfortable he makes the teams he's playing against, and how comfortable his teammates are, right? Like, I love that balancing act. But he told me that Allen Iverson is his favorite player. And then can see those AI, like the homage to AI a little bit with his handle. Like, his handle is ludicrous. And he had a crossover dribble against the New York Rens, went down the lane for a two-hand jam. Like, he can play above the rim, even though he's 6 foot and 165 pounds. His floater, his pull-up jumper inside the arc are just automatic. I think he was 62% on twos in 8 games at Peach Jam. Like, he's unreal. He's unreal. And I think he really captivated pretty much everybody in that gym. And it's a pretty insane rise for a player like this, who kind of defies all of like the size and physicality and like what a basketball player is supposed to look like. But skills pay the bills with him, and Caden Daughtry has skills out the wazoo.
I think the Trae Young comp is also inevitable with him, to your point. It's also fair. It's unfair to compare anybody to Stephen Curry. You can't do that. Like, but I'm saying it's going to happen when it comes to the 2028 draft cycle. He's going to be the first guy. There hasn't been a prospect that people say is like Steph, really, except for Trae Young. That was really the only one. But with Trae, that was unfair at the time. But I think with Caden Daughtry, the reason why I'm a little bit more open to it is because with Trae, there's no defense. With Caden Daughtry, you're pairing this unbelievable offense with great activity on the defensive end of the floor, this hard-nosed, tough mentality. And we'll see if that lasts over the course of time, deeper into his career. But seems like he has an amazing head on his shoulders, very intelligent. I'm blown away by every interview I've seen with him, on top of the play on the floor. I have not ranked my 2028 NBA draft prospects yet. I have not done that. I haven't watched these guys too deeply. But from what I've seen, Daughtry looks like a better prospect to me than Beckham Black. That's my very early impressions.
We'll see. I'm not quite there on that regard. Like, I think Beckham's really good, man. Like, I was really impressed with him too this week as well. But there's no doubt, I think right now, Caden Daughtry, you could make a strong case, as the better high school player. The thing with Caden too that I like is just the pace that he plays at. Like, he's just always begging for the basketball after a defensive rebound and wanting to go. Like, he just really wants to go. And I think about how the league is trending right now, playing in transition, getting easy shots, trying to score in the first 7 or 8 seconds of the shot clock before defenses can get set. Like, that's a lot of that stuff that he has is really, really special. But we can get into Beckham here in a little bit too. Like, I watch his game, and my first impression of him is like, this dude just knows how to hoop. Like, he can play on the ball, he can play off the ball, 6'3", 180 pounds. He's someone that you can build your offense around with his shot making. But I also just, I thought his decision making was really, really good. You know, this week he averaged 5.3 assists in his games for AB Elite. Now, the assist to turnover ratio was 2.4 to 1. That was excellent. But I think it's more than just the assist. It's more than just the assist to turnover ratio. It's like getting the ball from point A to point B in some of these actions was terrific, and it got his team good shots. So I was really impressed with him too. For me, I would have Beckham slightly ahead of Daughtry as like an NBA draft prospect, but it's hard to argue with Daughtry's production right now. Like, his production is just through the roof.
Who does Beckham Black better compare to? Obviously not his brother, Anthony Black, quite as much. Not as tall as him, but do you have a comp for Beckham Black?
I see a little bit of Braden Burry's, just with like that size and the ability to impact the game in a bunch of different ways. And then like the cutting is an underrated part of Beckham Black's game, just like it was for Braden Burry's. Like, Black, when he played off the ball, like, he sets up his back cuts terrific. He always moves without it. Like, he can obviously play through contact a little bit like Braden Burry's can as well. That's just a first name that I think of right now when I look at him. But we'll see, right? Like, there's a lot of time right, for him to continue to develop his game. We'll see if he has another growth spurt in his potential range of outcomes. But at 6'3" and 180 pounds, he's got just like this incredible base of size, physicality, feel, on-ball, off-ball versatility. He can shoot it. He gets to the free throw line. He can draw fouls at a high rate. Like, I just think he's a good player, like a really, really good player. And that was kind of my comp with Braden Burries as well. Like, I just would watch him and be like, yep, really good at basketball. That's how I feel when I watch Beckham Black too.
I think this week at Peach Jam, with all the excitement and, you know, online with these guys performing, especially Caden Daughtry at Peach Jam, it speaks to why teams are sort of looking ahead to 2028 over 2027 for draft classes. There's just like a lot of guys in that class where it's like, oh boy, these could be franchise changers for us. Whereas in 2027, it's not that it's going to be a horrific draft. I don't ever want to say that. I think there's a lot of good prospects who went back to school this year. You know, Crevis at Arizona. I can't wait to see what Swago does at Villanova. Thomas Hawk at Florida. It's like a lot of, let's see Elijah Arenas with a full year at USC. Amari Allen, you mentioned him in passing earlier, at Alabama entering year two. There's a lot of really good underclassmen still, and then some upperclassmen as well who could really stand out. I don't want to underrate it, but in terms of top-end talent, 2027 doesn't quite seem at the same level as 26 was, 25 was, or what 28 projects to be pretty early on right now.
That's a really important thing to talk about too right now. Like, you're going to go on, if you go on 247sports.com and look at the top recruits in 2027, it's like Beckham Black is number one. There's a really good chance that the number one recruit in 2027 is like fourth in the 2028 NBA draft because of the reclassification, right? Right now, three elite level prospects have reclassified to 2026. Joaquin Boumche, we call him JoJo, Boom Boom, whatever you want. He's at Duke. He's going to play college basketball for 2 years. Marcus Spears, he was the number one recruit in 2027. He just reclassified as well to Texas. He'll play 2 years of college basketball. And then Nikola Kusturica from Serbia, outstanding, outstanding prospect, just tore up Team USA in FIBA this summer, this past month. He's going to UCLA. And again, he's going to be in college for 2 years. Why? Like, it's NIL. Like, that's a huge part of all of this. A lot of high school players are trying to get their bags a little bit early. The ability to go to college, spend 2 years, that's two paychecks. So I would, as of right now, I'm looking at 2028. I would expect Boumche and Kusturica to be one and two in that, in some order, however order you want to order it right now. So then that class of 2027, there's a very good chance that Beckham Black might be the number one player in the class, but number four when the draft rolls around because of these reclassifications.
Exactly, especially because that size aspect. If Beckham Black doesn't grow to 6'6", you know, similar to his brother, Anthony Black, Marcus Spears is like, what, 6'10", 6'11"? All those other guys, I think, are above 6'6", 6'9". We'll see how they end up measuring without shoes or as we get better measurements over time. But that class, oh boy, 2028, there's a reason why you see some teams trying to load up on picks in that 2028 draft class. And it's because of the amount of elite level prospects there are that year. So it's like one off year for top end prospects, you know, Stokes and Smith and, you know, Branch and some of these guys, they're solid prospects, but they're nowhere near the level as what we just saw with Ibanza and Peterson and Boozer and Wilson, or what we will see again in 2028. So for the new draft lottery rules, that's the funny thing is, for like some of these picks this year, you may not want number one this year because that would mean you were not able to get number one in 2028. If you had a top five this year in 2026, you don't want top five again next year in 27, because that means you can't get top five in 2028. So there's going to be a lot of teams in the NBA this year winning, trying to win games, trying to get into the postseason, in part because of the new draft lottery rules where things are flattened, where play-in teams get odds, but also in part due to the fact that you don't want to be in the top five this year in certain cases. So I can't wait to see the way the league is with the new draft lottery rules. That's going to be exciting this coming season.
It is. And the other thing too, that I like about like just getting in the weeds with NBA draft stuff is like, when's the last time we've had 2 years to dive into like a potential number one pick like this at the college level in Joaquin Boumche Boumche, right? Again, if you haven't seen him, 6'10", 6'11", can really shoot the cover off the basketball from downtown. I think he's going to play some small ball five for Duke this year. I kind of project him as like, hey, be a good starter in year one. And then, hey, like we're going for National Player of the Year in year two. As a draft community, like when have we had a chance to like actually sink our teeth into 2 years of tape at the college ranks for some of these elite level prospects? I think it's going to be a good problem, maybe a first world problem, but a good problem to have because there's going to be a lot of strengths that get shown, but there's probably going to be some weaknesses that get exploited on the biggest stage because college basketball, as old as it's ever been and as talented as it's ever been, thanks to NIL.
I think with Boumche Boumche going to Duke especially, the amount of eyeballs that are always on Duke prospects, Duke as a team, period, as a college basketball team, the hype that could build for him after 2 years in college could be enormous and a good thing for the NBA as well. If more and more guys are reclassifying and spending 2 years in school, 2 years under the spotlight, 2 years of getting experience in really tough environments, tough, close, hostile games, that's what you want, is for these kids to become more seasoned over time. I mean, as nice as Peach Jam is, and like it's great to see guys go through it, it's an event for scouts, and it's an event for those types of people. It's not an event where fans are going crazy and there's pressure on you and there's cameras and there's millions of people watching. That's where I think these guys become really chiseled over time. And so I'm very excited for this 2 year cycle for some of these prospects that we're going to see. I'm already looking ahead to 2028. I mean, I'm 2027. I don't want to completely dismiss it by any means. It's going to still have good quality players, but the superstar level players are where 2028 is just pretty exhilarating. Am I underrating anybody in 2027? You think, Isaac, like, are you like a Stokes guy? Is there anybody that you're like, no, like you NBA people have it wrong. This guy has superstar potential.
I think Caleb Holt at Arizona is terrific. Every time I've watched him play, he's been outstanding. 6'5", 6'6". Again, I like the physical guards that just run through dudes. That's Caleb Holt a little bit. And I think that at Arizona, he's set up to thrive in that Tommy Lloyd system. They play in transition a ton. I think he's going to continually just smash in transition. And then just the defense. Like, he is a two-way player from the jump. I think that's something that you notice right away from his tape. And the shot has continually just improved. It's taken step after step after step as a prospect. So I think Holt is somebody there that I'm just curious about. And then Stokes, honestly, like the league just likes 6'7", 6'8" guys that can pass, dribble, and shoot. Like they just do. And so I'm just more curious about his maturity, how he continually finds ways to impact the game when the ball is not in his hands. I think he picked the right spot at Kansas. Because Bill Self is really good at handling some of the personalities like this. But I'm just kind of curious how his game continues to coalesce over the you know, oncoming year. But you're right. Like, as I'm starting to do these, like, way too early 2027 NBA drafts, mock drafts, it's like, my God, like, where are we at here? I feel like there's just a lot of guys in, like, the 15s through the 25 range that I'm like, man, like, they're just begging to get leaped over. I would throw a couple sleeper names. I think David Mirkovich at Illinois is a 6'9". Pass, dribble, shoot forward, really, really high feel. If his body gets under control, I think he could be a guy that you could hear in the lottery. And then there's just a lot of interesting cats that like went back for year two, like a Matt Abel had a chance to be drafted in the first round, goes back to North Carolina after transferring to North Carolina from NC State. If he puts it all together, man, at 6'5", 6'6", great size, great shot making, can play on the ball, can play off the ball. If he puts it together, he's going to be somebody that, like, hey, maybe you see in the 20s right now in a way too early mock, but he could push for the lottery.
Tunde Yesufu transferring to St. John's from Baylor, another guy. You know, Tyler Tanner going back to Vanderbilt again this year, another small guard. Maybe things don't improve for him. Maybe he explodes. Who knows with guys like that? It's definitely an interesting draft class, and I think when there's no clear-cut top guy, I think that's where it makes some of these debates more and more interesting. So I'm excited for it from that standpoint. But for the casual fan, there's not that guy where it's like, ah, AJD Bonsa could be my savior. He can change everything for us. I don't think there's quite that guy, at least not yet. We'll see how the year develops. Isaac, thank you so much for joining me today, man. People can check out your stuff at CBS Sports and 24/7 as well. Thanks for coming on, man.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back after this break. All right, joining me now from The Athletic and Raptors Republic, once again this month, it's S. Barahini. S, what's up?
What's going on? Hello, KOC. How's it going? Living the dream, man.
All right, so I want to talk about the Odyssey with you. Before we get to that, we're going to talk about Allen Graves, who looks like a hit of a draft prospect for the Toronto Raptors. Looks sensational, man. Like, he showed off all the goods. He shot over 40% from three, connective passing, solid defensively. For all the questions about translating to the NBA, at least a first step in summer league, looked good. What was your takeaways for the 19th pick in the draft, Allen Graves?
I mean, you just talked about it, but he was everything you kind of expected him or wanted him to be. I thought the shot was there. You talked about the percentage, but also most of his shots were off of the catch, above the break. Just a good sign in terms of his positioning and where he'll be in the Raptors' offense mostly. You know, the Raptors like to have their bigs and their wings kind of orient and create from above the break, you know, whether it be dribble handoffs or these pick and pop situations. So I think like positioning Allen to kind of work in those areas of the floor already is something that's a kind of a sign of what's to come for him. I think his, like, what surprised me the most, and maybe you can speak on this, was they actually spammed pick and rolls for him. After his first game, which he dominated, he was running so many pick and rolls. And in Vegas, I actually talked to Summer League head coach for the Raptors, Ivo Simović, about this. Like, I was like, hey, you guys are running a lot of pick and roll situations for Allen Graves. And he's like, yes, we want to see him get those reps. We want to see him just kind of like stretch his legs as a playmaker. And I thought he did a really great job of manipulating the defense. I thought his handle was much better and more advanced than I thought it was in Santa Clara. It feels like he's taken a leap on that end. And so the connective passing that he showed off in college, I think, is kind of lending itself to becoming an even better on-ball creator at some point. We're probably a couple steps away from that, but it is at least intriguing that the Raptors see that development path for him moving forward.
Well, the interesting thing is, if you go back to his numbers on Synergy at Santa Clara, as a freshman last year coming off the bench, he ran two pick and rolls as the ball handler.
Yeah, crazy.
They primarily used him as an off-ball guy, setting screens, when he had the ball on ball, it was posting up, facing up. It wasn't necessarily operating with a ball screen, as you're saying. We saw from him a little bit with Toronto this summer league, and I think that's what's interesting, because with Allen Graves, he grew up playing point guard. He grew up in a family of point guards. When I had him on my podcast the day before the draft, he said to me, his dad, you know, growing up would say to him, we don't raise anybody but point guards. Like we're all, well, we're point guard family. And then he sprouts up to 6'7", 6'8", whatever his actual listed height is. It's like, well, you know, he's a big guard. He's a big guard. And so I think with Toronto, they're trying to tap into a little of that. But to your point, obviously, there's other mouths to feed on Toronto. There's more proven players. He's not going to get as many of those opportunities for the big league squad as he did for the summer league squad. But ultimately, I do think there's something there with Graves. The people who were bullish on him as a prospect, and one of the reasons why I want to talk about him with you, is because I think he really was one of the standouts of those like non-lottery picks. To me, he was one of the guys where I'm like, okay, there's no like Keaton Wagler with the Clippers. There's the question going in as the fifth pick with his lack of athleticism, no dunks last year, with his ability to translate to NBA speed and athleticism. And he did get better as summer league went on. But with Allen Graves, there's that same question. He's a little slow. He's not an explosive athlete, and he still does look slow, but he looked like he was in complete command. And I thought athletically, he didn't look overmatched at all. And I think for the Toronto Raptors, a team that already has so much size and length and versatility with Colin Murray-Boyles last year, hopefully the Kawhi Leonard deal becomes official very, very soon. Adding Allen Graves to this, it almost feels like some of those championship Raptors teams doesn't it, S? When they had Kawhi last time and Siakam and all those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, they definitely, they're trying to build something in the vision of that 2019 team. And you think of, you know, Jamal Shedd as that nice backup point guard, Jacoby Walter as sort of the wing that comes off the bench, similar to what Norman Powell was for that 2019 team. Now, who knows if that the talent of this 2026 team is as talented as 2019, where there's like, I think there's something like four all-stars from that team between Kawhi, Kyle, Pascal, Norm. Was Fred an all-star? Yes, Fred was an all-star. So there's five all-stars, not including Marc Gasol, who before 2019 was like defensive player of the year, multiple time all-star himself. So that 2019 team was incredibly talented. This 2026 team, I think, is working on the basis of some of their guys hopefully eventually will get to that point. We'll see if they can kind of get it all together at once. The other thing I will say about Allen Graves, I was really surprised by how well he dealt with physicality, especially in that, like, at the rim, short range area. I was pretty surprised just at how well he handled that, but also how well he got to his spots when he was driving. The fouling will be an issue. He fouled a bunch, especially on defense, and maybe that goes to the slow-footed thing that you just mentioned. I think this will be the perfect context for him to develop that, though, to your point, because there are so many good defenders. So while on one end he dealt with physicality in a really good way offensively, I think defensively the physicality is something that I'm really interested in.
Yeah, I agree with you there. The physicality, and he did have foul trouble in college as well, so mm-hmm. that's going to be an adjustment for him. But look, he's a bench guy. As a rookie, it's not absolutely. Like you need him to play 35 minutes per game. You have Scotty Barnes and Colin Murray Boyles and hopefully Kawhi Leonard and a bunch of other good quality players in that Raptors rotation. And that's what you need him to be, is a really good quality guy off the bench playing rotation minutes and working through those growing pains over the course of time. And I think for the Toronto Raptors, people often talk about when it comes to the decision that LeBron James will make, they say, well, the East has such an easier path to the NBA Finals and the Western Conference. And in some regards, that's true because of the top with Victor Wembanyama and the Spurs. And of course, the Thunder should be back in. And there's tons of other loaded teams in the West. But the East has the champs in the Knicks. Hey, the Pistons could be better potentially. The Cavs could have LeBron, obviously, on their team. The Raptors should be better with hopefully Kawhi Leonard. The Hawks could be better. The Sixers should be better. Like, I think the East is a little bit underrated, in part because of Toronto being a team that was really, really good last year at 46 wins, a really, really hard out with a great defense. And next year, with a little bit more development from Scotty Barnes, a little bit more development from Jacoby Walter, and with a veteran star in Kawhi and an upside rookie in Allen Graves, Toronto, I think, is another one of those reasons why the East path isn't quite as easy as people might make it out to be compared to the West.
No, and look, I will say the fact that this Kawhi trade is in limbo makes things a little bit more difficult to kind of gauge where the East mm-hmm. is at, because, you know, given the state of this Kawhi trade, you know, we never know what will happen. It feels like this trade will eventually happen. The Clippers and Raptors both feel very confident that eventually this trade will go down. But that also changes the trajectory of the Toronto Raptors in a major way. You talked about how much the East has gotten better. Well, if the Raptors are the exact same team and they're just bringing in Brandon Ingram again next season, then I think they've taken a step back. And if it is Kawhi Leonard that they're bringing in, I completely agree with you. This team catapults themselves into one of those teams in the Eastern Conference that has a puncher's chance of winning a title. And as we've seen in the NBA over the last eight seasons, you only need one shot. You just need a chance at it. And I think the Raptors with Kawhi in the fold, to your point, between Scotty, between Jacoby Walter, between the bench that I think has gotten deeper, that aspect, they have a chance. It just really depends if this Kawhi trade goes through.
Before we go, S, I want to talk real quick with you about the Odyssey. I saw it on Friday night at the Providence, Rhode Island 70mm IMAX theater. I drove an hour down there. My car drove me an hour down there. And had a great time. I know you saw it in 70 millimeter last night. You were posting about it on X. I saw it 10 p.m. showing, late night showing for a 3-hour movie. I read your Letterboxd review. You gave it 4.5 stars out of 5. I gave it 4 out of 5. And I know you're a Nolan guy too. You said you compared it to Steph Curry's finals MVP or Dirk's title run. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Because it's undeniable at this point. Because it is undeniable at this point. Even if you are a Christopher Nolan skeptic, even if you're someone who's like, those movies are not for me, this movie should at the very least get your admiration and appreciation. The sheer scale of this thing, the fact that this man, in and without any spoilers, used scuba divers for one of the scenes on a beach, like the fact that he used jet skis to create an actual whirlpool, like these things are not normal. We have to kind of understand how incredible and how incredibly hard it is for a filmmaker to make something as big as The Odyssey is. And to do it with IMAX cameras where every single take is a grand total of 3 minutes, and to have to capture that within 3 minutes, every single thing into a 3-hour movie is a achievement unto itself. Now, that is just the filmmaking aspect. The actual story was incredible. And you know, I think it sheds light on modern society today, but also just society in general crumbling, our faculties being destroyed, what it means to essentially live in a world where you are led by men and what men do in such a corrupt world or corrupt the world themselves. It tackles a lot of fascinating things. And I think, yes, this is exactly what I was going to bring up. It is, in my opinion, a spiritual prequel to Oppenheimer, or maybe sequel to Oppenheimer, because it grapples with the same thing, essentially two men who end a war and have to deal with the repercussions of that, both psychologically with themselves and within society, kind of what kind of Pandora's box they have both opened up because of their actions. And I think that, again, it shows you a lot about society today too, man. So I loved it. I'd love to get your thoughts. I think it was a great movie. Would it be like, is it the best Christopher Nolan movie? Maybe not. I'd have to sit with it more. But it is the most Christopher Nolan movie. It's the most Christopher Nolan movie, which is, I think, a very, very high compliment. You know,
that's a good way to put it. And I think the reason why is because it deals with those philosophical questions that you're talking about, but also just the sheer magnitude of it. It's insane. Just a massive movie, a hell of an achievement, beautifully made, like all of the Christopher Nolan films are. Is it my favorite? No. It's not. To me, my big three is Interstellar, Inception, and Dark Knight. And then my Nolan rankings after that, I have Prestige, Dunkirk, Memento, Oppenheimer, and then Odyssey is 8th. And so I posted this list on X with my top 12. Following, I'd have 13th for what it's worth. And I like the following. I like all of Nolan's films.
People
are like, oh, you're a hater. How do you have Odyssey this low? How do you have Interstellar number one? You're such a basic, stick the basketball, Nolan fan, this and that. Whatever. And it's like, I mean, come on. I saw Interstellar.
For what it's worth, I also have Interstellar first. We're aligned there.
It is the best in theater experience. I saw it 3 times in IMAX opening month, opening night, the next day with friends, weeks later with my parents back in 2014, whatever year it was released. And it's the best in theater experience I've ever had. Now, these are my rankings based off of my review at the time of the first watching. Maybe I'd shift things around a little bit nowadays, but Odyssey 8 feels appropriate to me. It's still an amazing film. It's just more a testament to your point,
dude,
that it is undeniable. Nolan, he has this many great films.
Exactly.
Memento at 6th. Memento is amazing.
Exactly.
It's incredible.
This would be like trying to parse through. Again, this is why I called it Steph's finals MVP, because it's just like,
it's a great comp.
At the
it's
end
a
of the
really
day, like, there are so many great things that Steph Curry has done in his career. He obviously has had multiple all-time seasons, the unanimous MVP, whatever you want to call it. That could have been Interstellar. Oppenheimer might have been the time where he won a champion. Like, but this to me was the movie where he's like, all right, man, here you go. this is what it means to make a Christopher Nolan movie. Mm-hmm. All right, God, you know, like I just, it was great. It was excellent. I think I would probably have The Odyssey a little bit higher than you, but that's not, it's whatever. I looked at your rankings.
Oh, you did. You have five stars for Oppenheimer, Dark Knight, Prestige, Dunkirk, and Inception. Yes.
Yeah, Odyssey, I love all of them.
You have Odyssey 4.5. Yes, so what held it back from being in the class of those five star movies?
I will say, I'm trying to be harsher on what I give a five star to. Like, I'm trying to tame myself a little bit more. I originally put The Odyssey as a 5, and then I was just like, man, I don't know. Maybe I should make it a 4.5. Like, what's... I'm just trying to be hard. Why? I felt like last year I gave too many 5 stars. Like, I looked through my list at Letterboxd.
You have one battle after another 5 stars. I mean, it's a good movie. Come on, 5 stars.
It was a great movie.
It's not a 5-star movie.
Sinners, 5 stars for me. So, please. Anyways. What? No, come
it's
on.
Fine. Sinners was a very, very boring first hour or so.
Insane. Insanity. You know what? I am also one of those people, admittedly, whether it is basketball or whether it is movies or music or anything, I'm very easily caught up in the romantic aspect of those arts. So I like watch it and I'm like, wow, how was this made? This is incredible. And so that can sweep you a little bit. Like, for instance, I don't know if you've watched this yet, but there's a movie from Toronto called Nirvana, the Band, the Show, the Movie. I would highly recommend it if you haven't yet. And I can't believe I'm putting it on this podcast so everybody in the world can end up going and watching this movie. I gave it a 5-star because it's so accurate and funny and incredible and witty, and it's just great. But I had to scale it back and give it a 4.5 stars because is it truly a 5-star movie? I don't know. It's a hard thing to distinguish.
I'll tell you what made it 4-star for me. I felt like even though it was a 3-hour movie, on one hand, it didn't feel 3 hours. When it was over, I was like, wow, it's over already. It's an amazing achievement for its pace to feel so quick, for it not to feel like 3 hours. But the downside of that, at least in my opinion, is it felt a little choppy to me, a little disjointed. It felt like they had a mandate to be under 3 hours, whereas in this case, I think an extra 20-25 minutes could have helped it personally. That was one of my feelings from a filmmaking standpoint. No specific examples from it. I don't want to spoil anything, but I just felt a little choppy at times.
The first hour and a half felt very episodic. Like, here's this thing, here's this thing, here's this thing. And then the second half of the movie really flows, especially once they get to a certain scene. And so I agree with you. I think that was part of why I decided to go from 5-star to 4.5-star. I would also say just like it was bloated. There were a lot of actors, a lot of great cast members in this. And while Matt Damon obviously shines, and Anne Hathaway obviously shines, and I love John Leguizamo's character, who is basically the servant in Ithaca, he was incredible in this. I just feel like there were too many great actors for anybody to really like dominate other than Matt Damon. Matt Damon was great. I think Matt Damon probably ends up getting nominated for an Oscar, maybe wins the Oscar. But like, it was so bloated that you didn't get people really leaning into their characters enough, or maybe spending enough time with characters. Like, we didn't get a chance to see too much of Helen of Troy. We didn't get a chance to see too much of Sinon. So like we saw them, but we didn't see too much of them, which I think is another aspect of why I dinged it, you know, to 4.5 stars.
One of the questions on my mind as a Nolan head is, what's next for Nolan? Because he keeps going bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, how could it have ever gotten bigger than Interstellar? And yet it has. Every single film has. Dunkirk, Oppenheimer, and now The Odyssey. The Odyssey, 3,000-year-old story. I think, and this is one of my main takeaways from this film, is Nolan needs to scale down for the next one and do the horror film that he has long wanted to do. And this is a non-spoiler here. The Cyclops scene and the pig scene, the way in which they were filmed, I was on edge. It was kind of scary in a way. And I was like, oh my God, like walking out of the theater, he's got to do a horror film. I want to see a Nolan spin on one. He just needs the script. I don't know if he has it or he'll just direct somebody else's script, but I want to see Nolan do horror. See, he doesn't need to go big for the next one. Just scale it down. Do something smaller, memento-sized movie, you know?
Sure, maybe. I have no idea what he'll do, because to your point, it is becoming a little bit like Fast and the Furious in the sense like every Nolan movie is crazier and crazier, and at some point you just outpace the actual like theme or topic of the movie. So I don't know what he'll do next. I didn't think he was going to do the Odyssey after after Oppenheimer. I wasn't really sure. I thought he might have tackled something different, maybe do a space movie again. I would like to see horror. I thought this was maybe his version of a horror. Like, I would say between the elements that you mentioned, some of the other dark elements that we see in the movie, this was kind of his horror movie. This felt like his horror movie. There were moments where it felt like his horror movie.
It's not a true horror, though.
You're right.
But he needs a pure horror movie.
Yeah, I get you. I understand. What about a Western? A Western for Dune, for Nolan would be cool, too. I think that'd
How
be
about a Western horror? I just want to see
a horror movie. Yeah, why not?
You saw it in 70mm IMAX, so that means you saw the 4-minute Dune 3 preview before it, right? Dude,
yes,
that was so
incredible.
Sick. Denny Villeneuve also was building his really long list of strong movies as well. I didn't love Dune 1. Is. I was bored by Dune 1, just being honest. I thought Dune 2 was incredible. Dune 3, from everybody I've talked to that's read the book, says this is where things get insane, where they get awesome. And based off the preview, oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, I need my ticket now.
Absolutely. You talk about scale and being able to do it in scale. If you go at look at Denis Villeneuve's filmography, shout out to another Canadian, by the way, Denis Villeneuve. His ability to scale up in every movie is insane. It's insane. Like, you go early on in his career and you watch like The Arrivals and The Prisoners of the World, and it's really about story and tackling things and trying to scale up the actual scope of his stories. And then with Dune, it's blowing it out the water. And Denis is apparently going to do a James Bond movie too. So I'm very curious to see how that looks.
Nice.
But yeah, I'm excited, man. It feels like he's kind of the next Nolan version. You know, he's captivating the audience with these big scale movies. I'm very fascinated to see how Dune 3 looks. It looked incredible. That 4-minute teaser that we got was enough for me to say, sign me up. It was definitely more exciting than the Avengers Doomsday trailer that I watched this morning. I don't know if you watched it yet, but there was Avengers Doomsday trailer and I saw it.
I'm not a superhero movie guy. I'm never going to see it.
Fair enough.
I'm never going to see it in my life. I have no interest in seeing it. I'm never going
to. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to see it. I'll be there in the first day, probably watching it right after Dune. But at the same time, it's just like, man, it doesn't provide me with the same level of excitement.
Is it the same release date?
It's the same release date, man. Oh, yes. So
people can do a double feature. What was the Barbie Oppenheimer, right? That was the same
Barbenheimer.
Thing, right?
Now it's Dunesday is the thing they're calling it. So we'll see. But yeah.
I'll see Dune and then go home happily. After that. I'm not a superhero. How many Avengers can they have?
It's true. It's true. Yeah.
You know what else I've never seen? I've never seen Fast and the Furious. I've never seen any of them.
Wow, really?
I've never seen any of them?
No. Okay, so you gotta at least watch like the first four or five. I will say the first four or five are creme de la creme. They're good. You know what? You would enjoy Tokyo Drift. Tokyo Drift is a good movie.
Maybe I'll check that one out. Thank you so much for joining me again today, man. Always good to chat with you. Talking Alan Graves is just the excuse to bring you on. Thanks for coming on the Odyssey, S.
Of course. Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
People can check out S. Barahini's work at Raptors Republic and, of course, at The Athletic with his NBA Daily Show with Dave Dufour. S, thanks.
Thanks, man.
Big thank you to Isaac Trotter and S. Barahini for joining me in today's episode. Thank you to Emmy and the whole team for producing today's show. We'll be back again maybe tomorrow, maybe later tonight, whenever LeBron makes his decision, but we'll be definitely having a show on Thursday. Tom Haberstraw and I will talk about whatever's going on around the NBA. Hopefully LeBron signs by then. You'll hear from us as soon as that happens. Have a good day, everybody.